So I gave this talk title something like From the End of the Dark Ages to Now. The idea was that I could talk about almost anything, having put that there, so that's what I'm going to do. I just put names of all my collaborators here. You see quite a lot of them. So this talk, I want to follow on a little bit from the two talks we've had the last 2 days. Since the main thing I'm going to focus on is right at the top here, and that's dwarf galaxies in the cold dark matter model of the universe. This is one of these things which has been promoted as a crisis for the cold dark matter model, as Mark was talking about yesterday. But it's something which involves all this messy astrophysics that we've been hearing about as well. So what I want to do is try and model that as best as possible, and of course that's pretty difficult, but I'll try and show you what we can do and how far we can go. So I'm going to try and answer this question of how many dwarf galaxies we might expect to see in the local group. I'll explain why that's interesting in a little while. And hopefully I'll get on to talk about all this other interesting stuff, such as quasar spectra, near reionization, heating of galactic disks, galaxies in voids, and galaxy clustering, and so on. But we'll just see how far I get on that. but this main thing I want to talk about is dwarf galaxies in the local group. So this is an N-body simulation. I'm sure you've all seen endless pictures like this before. This one's actually from Ben Moore. And it's a simulation of a dark matter halo similar to the one that we think the Milky Way lives in. So this, the virial radius is somewhere kind of out here, around 300 kiloparsecs. And it contains a total mass, something in the region of 10 to the 12 solar masses. And the Milky Way would presumably be sitting somewhere right down in the center here. Yeah, and this is redshift zero. Yeah. But you'll notice that there's a lot of other things around. You can see these very large objects, which you might want to associate with something like the Large Magellanic Cloud. And then there are several hundred of these smaller objects as well. And naively, when you look at this, you might think, well, this dark matter halo is built through the merging of all these smaller objects. You might expect that these small objects, when they first formed and were sort of isolated systems themselves, would form some galaxy. They would be able to accrete gas, begin to form stars. And if you assume nothing else particularly dramatic happened, then they should still contain those stars. So this halo, which we think in the cold dark matter model corresponds to a local environment, should contain something of order several hundred of these small galaxies. And an important thing to note is that if you take that naive assumption and do some very simple calculations, the luminosity that you'd associate with these things is, although it's very low, it's sufficient that we would have actually detected most of these galaxies. They're not just too faint that we don't see them in this simple picture. But, and here's a very simple diagram of the real local group. This is just a projection into a plane. The two red dots you see here are the Milky Way and M31. And the blue dots are all the other galaxies we know about in the local group, the dwarf galaxies in general. And you notice a few things. For a start, the most impressive thing that there are only maybe 10 or 20 of these small galaxies around. So at least an order of magnitude or more less than the number of these substructure dark matter halos that we see in this simulation. So this is the basis of this crisis. There are many, many more of these dark matter objects than we see galaxies in the local group. So this is what I want to try and address. Now, I should just point out these green circles I've drawn on here actually correspond to what we think the virial radii of the dark matter halo of the Milky Way and M31 correspond to. They're about 300 kiloparsecs, something in that region. And you'll notice that, so this is the sort of extent of the Milky Way system that we consider to be, you know, where the material is strongly bound to the Milky Way. You'll see that a lot of these local group galaxies actually lie beyond that region. So although observationally these things are known as local group galaxies, from a theoretical definition, I'm less inclined to consider them as real members of the Milky Way or M31 system. are just things that happen to be nearby. So most of this talk I'm really going to just focus on the things inside these circles.
What's the meaning of the green circle?
So it's the virial radius of the Milky Way's halo. It's the, you can consider it the collapsed region, essentially. I mean, these, if you, in terms of velocity dispersion, these smallest galaxies go down to around 10 kilometers per second. So this, yeah, it's an interesting question. So the faintest galaxy we see in here has an absolute magnitude of about -8, -9, somewhere in that region. And if you talk, when I talk to people who do these observations, they claim if there were fainter things, they would be able to see them, at least if they were close here. So the surface brightness is the real killer.
They're still finding dwarf galaxies.
Yeah, precisely. So this was actually originally plotted from a compilation in 98, but if you go to the literature now, there are four other galaxies which I've actually added on, but were found more recently than that. So I think at those faintest magnitudes, it's not completely clear that it's faint, that it's, sorry, complete.
It's hard to find these things by looking at the stars. Especially
that's right. I mean, most of these things are found by looking at maps of stars, looking for overdensities in the sort of background population.
There's some,
and it's very difficult. That's right. Yeah.
But then you have to worry about the observation.
Right.
So, excuse me, if I understand what Steve is saying, that if better observation is something you could go away, no?
I don't think so. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the problem exists even for the brighter things, where it's much more likely that we are complete. So, I think the problem definitely exists.
Yeah.
How do you determine the virial rate? So, it's there's cause somewhat arbitrary. You know the velocity. The velocity dispersion of the Milky Way halo based on the disk rotation. And then for a given cosmological model, you can calculate what mass halo that would correspond to at redshift zero. Or what I actually did was took a characteristic collapsed redshift for something like the Milky Way and did the calculation there. So there's the fact that if you do things properly, what you would call the circular velocity of the halo at the virial radius is less than the disk speed, because the disk obviously has its own self-gravity as well. But that's accounted for. This is done by fitting a whole model to the rotation curve. So, I mean, it's just the best estimate you can do. It's not, I mean, again, the virial radius is sort of arbitrary anyway, so.
One does have a reason to deploy the estimate for the mass of the galaxy. The mass is currently not the virial radius.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I think Mark covered this nicely yesterday, so I won't spend much time on it, but possible solutions to this, well, one involves getting rid of the substructure in the dark matter itself. So you can do this by changing the nature of dark matter or the initial conditions to remove that small-scale power, and then of course you never form these small objects. There are actually recently tight constraints from the high redshift Lyman alpha forest, so this is the absorption lines seen in quasar spectra. If you get rid of too much of that small-scale power, you wouldn't see these absorption lines. So they're constrained from that. There's also a question. So Felix Storr and Simon White showed that in the cold dark matter picture, the velocity dispersions of the local group galaxies actually fit in quite nicely with the dark matter halos which are present. And it's not clear then that this would actually be true in any model where you suppress much of that power. Well, that's not been shown yet. So another possibility is supernova explosions. If there are a lot of supernova going off in these small objects that have fairly shallow potential wells, you might expect you can blow out a lot of the gas from them, reduce the number of stars they form, and then they just become too faint for you to see. So the kind of current galaxy models, go away. Kind of current galaxy models usually include this supernova explosions, but in order to produce a flat slope for the global luminosity function of galaxies. So it's a fairly standard ingredient. But it turns out you need to make it much stronger to explain the local group. Of course, these models of supernova are usually entirely empirical. There's no real physics in them, because it's just not understood that well. So maybe the physics is sufficiently different from the empirical rules that we use that this could still be an explanation. But in any case, if you make this feedback strong enough, then you're into problems with mass-to-light ratios in these satellites. I won't go into any detail about that, but it doesn't look too promising. So the other thing is that the other possibility is this is the effects of reionization. I'll explain how that works a little later. This was most recently pointed out by Bullock et al., although it has a much longer history of people looking at this kind of effect. Should say as well, actually, that in the figure I showed you with the M-body simulation, those simulations which have really brought this problem as a kind of popular thing to talk about, but that problem has been known for much longer on the basis of people doing analytic calculations. Back in the sort of early 90s, people were pointing this out using the pressure ejector technique. So it's been known for quite a long time. Anyway, so reionization, what it turns out, is going to suppress the formation of low-mass galaxies at low redshifts, so that only those which form at high redshifts before the universe got reionized are going to contain any visible stars that you can detect. So Bullock et al. Did some simple calculations that suggest this may work. What we want to do is to try and do this in much more detail and see just how well it stands up. There's another really nice thing about this, that in the field of galaxy formation, the physics is generally very complicated and not well understood. This is something of an exception, that the physics is reasonably simple, reasonably well understood, so it's a nice problem to tackle. And it also seems to be unavoidable, since we know the universe was reionized. So if we claim to have a model for galaxy formation, we should really be accounting for this. So I'll very briefly give you, this is a really simple picture of the reionization of the universe. So at high redshifts, the IGM is completely neutral. I'm just going to consider the hydrogen here in the IGM, ignore all the helium and anything else. So there'll be a few very small dark matter halos which are forming at that redshift. And the IGM is nice and cold, so they can accrete that gas. You can ignore the pressure of the gas and it will just behave in the same way as the dark matter. They're going to accrete that gas and presumably begin to form stars and maybe quasars. So the stars and quasars are going to emit ionizing photons, and you're going to start to photoionize the hydrogen in the IGM. So the consequence is that eventually, when you produce enough photons, the IGM becomes ionized, and the side effect is that you heat it up to around 10 to the 4 Kelvin. So it never gets much hotter just because cooling becomes too efficient at higher temperatures. And we think this happens somewhere around redshift 6 now, give or take a redshift or so. And the result is that at redshift 0, there are now a lot of dark matter halos forming, but there are two interesting effects here now. First of all, the gas in the IGM is very hot, it's around 10 to the 4 Kelvin. Its genus mass is now pretty high, comparable to the masses of some of these small halos. So the pressure of that gas is now important, and it's going to stop it collapsing as efficiently into the dark matter potential well. There's another effect that in order to form a galaxy, you need to cool gas. If that gas is hot, it just supports itself through pressure. You need to cool it so it can collapse and form a galaxy. Now, since the universe is now ionized, these ionizing photons can just propagate through most of the universe. The mean free path is very long. You build up an ionizing background, and this is going to heat gas in these halos, so it effectively stops it cooling. So these two effects are both consequences of the universe becoming reionized, and they both act to suppress the formation of galaxies in these low-mass halos. So these are the two effects which are going to hopefully have something.
Another effect of the 40 UK
burn? It's essentially when you get to that temperature, you've ionized all the hydrogen. So you now have all the cooling processes that can. Yeah, essentially corresponds to that. Yeah. So that's pretty well fixed.
If you were ionized by quasars, it could be possible because it's not quite important. But
that's right. Right. Exactly. Well. Yeah, the dark matter doesn't care. It has only interacts through gravity, so it just does its own thing. so that's an interesting point. That, of course, what I'm trying to do here is suppress the formation of the baryons, but all that dark matter substructure would still be hanging around. If I have time, I'll comment on that a little later. So there is actually one other thing which may help here. I kind of commented on earlier. And I said, even if you form these galaxies at some point, maybe you could destroy them before the present day, so you wouldn't see them. And one way that we know, what we think, must act and could do that is just through tidal disruption of galaxies as they orbit around in this large potential well of the Milky Way. So the idea is, this is just a simple model, that some galaxy, small galaxy, forms in a halo at high redshift, and later through the sort of normal hierarchical merging, merges into this larger potential well. And it's going to begin to orbit around in here. In the numerical simulations it is, yes. What I'm going to show you is an analytic calculation of this. So the kind of simple model that I can do to account for this effect is, so I follow the orbit of this small halo, calculate the tidal radius, just based on the potential of the larger halo, and I'm going to assume that any mass beyond that outer tidal region is just pulled away on order of the orbital timescale. You can then continue to follow the orbit, accounting for dynamical friction. So this is going to gradually make the orbit lose energy and spiral in towards the center. When it gets to those very central regions, you get a sort of related effect of gravitational heating. The tidal field is now changing very rapidly, as seen by this orbiting satellite. It kind of gets squashed and stretched, and you begin to deposit energy into it. And this, in effect, heats up that halo, makes it less strongly bound, so it's even easier to pull mass away from the outer regions. So then there are two possibilities. Essentially, if the tidal processes are very strong, you can destroy the entire object, and you never see that galaxy. It's just completely destroyed. And we actually see this happening in around the Milky Way. For example, the Sagittarius dwarf galaxy is seen to be pulled apart. You see these long streams coming off it. Well, the other possibility is that if the dynamical friction is strong enough and you have enough time, then this object will just eventually merge right to the center and presumably merge with the galaxy sitting at the bottom of the potential well. So that's another way that you might get rid of these galaxies. Possibly. So in the simulations, that's already all accounted for, at least with, you got to bear in mind the caveats of the resolution, which make it, I mean, they may even overestimate it, for example. But in previous calculations that people have done using, the pressure ejector technique and analytic approaches, that was never accounted for. So any halo that formed always survived forever and ever. But now we can actually account for that particular process. And it's not a huge effect, but it is important, so. No, you do get the heating as well. It's just a gravitational effect. Yeah. So what I did was to embed this kind of new processes into one of these semi-analytic models. This is the one that was developed at Durham. And I'm sure a lot of you know all about these things. Those that don't, it's this is really just you're trying to model the formation of galaxies starting from essentially initial conditions, the power spectrum laid down by inflation. So this is a pretty optimistic thing to try and do, but it you kind of try and model all the physics that you think is important: the growth of dark matter, cooling of gas, star formation, galaxy mergers, and try and model all that analytically as best you can, and use it to predict a wide range of properties for galaxies, such as their luminosities, their structure and dynamics, star formation rates, and so on. So I'm going to treat it pretty much as just a black or blue box in this case for this talk, but if you have any questions, just please ask. What I will talk about in a little more detail is how I link together two models. So I have this model, a semi-analytic model for how galaxies form, but also in order to follow the reionization of the universe, I have a model for the IGM, and the two are linked together. So I use the semi-analytic model to tell me the star formation history of the universe, and that tells me how many ionizing photons were emitted at each redshift. And I can feed that emissivity into a simple model of the IGM, solve the equations for the ionization and heating and cooling rates, and what you get out of that are things such as the mean density of neutral hydrogen in the IGM, its mean temperature, and also a spectrum for the ionizing background. So this ionizing background spectrum immediately tells you the rate that gas is heated in dark matter halos. So this is one of the effects we wanted to include. The temperature of the IGM immediately lets you work out the gene's mass. It just depends on the temperature and the density, so that's very easy to do. It turns out that the gene's mass is not quite the thing you want in order to calculate how much gas a dark matter halo will accrete. It would be if the universe was not expanding and if the temperature was constant with time. Right. Yeah.
What you're trying to do here is just put the gas on a high 80 amount.
Exactly, yeah. That's right. So the gene's mass is not quite the thing you want. There's a related quantity called the filtering mass, which essentially just accounts for all those things. And you can basically think of it as being the equivalent of the gene's mass but delayed by some amount of time. It takes the gas so long to respond to changes in temperature and to changes in temperature. But the important thing is that if you know temperature, you can calculate this very easily. And if you know this, you can calculate how much gas any dark matter halo will accrete. So you can feed these two things back into your model, repeat that calculation of star formation rates, and typically you find that slightly different than what you started with, because now you've suppressed a lot of the star formation in small halos. So you have to iterate around this whole loop a few times to find a converged solution, but it turns out it's usually very rapid, so it's not a real problem. So I'll show you some interesting results from this. First one is just what effect this has on the global star formation rate in the universe. So this plot is showing you the rate of star formation per unit volume as a function of redshift. This is from redshift 0 to 20. The red line here, which you can only just make out, is the prediction from this semi-analytic model without including any of these new effects I've been talking about. If I switch those effects on, the effects of reionization and the tidal disruption of satellites, then I get this green line. So you see at high redshift, the two are identical essentially, because the universe isn't reionized yet, so there should be no difference. When you get to these lower redshifts, just before the universe gets reionized in hydrogen, which is here, you see a small suppression in the star formation rate, sort of 10 to 20% suppression. It then recovers, and then at this redshift 3 in this model, helium becomes ionized, doubly ionized, and there's another small suppression in the star formation rate. And this is just because you switch off, as you heat up the universe, you switch off star formation in the low mass halos. This is only a very small effect, which is initially quite surprising. So let me show you an alternative model. This is the same model as the red line, but now I switched off all the effects of supernova explosions. These supernova explosions normally limit star formation in dark matter halos in these models. I've now switched that off completely. So the first thing you notice is there's much more star formation, not surprisingly, just because now you have nothing to limit it except cooling, the time it takes gas to cool, essentially. And I should point out, this model would be very unrealistic. You'd produce way more stars than we actually see in the universe. But this is just for an example. So if I now switch on the effects of reionization, you'll see there's actually a very big suppression now. It's a factor 2 or 3 suppression in the star formation rate. And this is because when I don't include any supernova feedback, that's really annoying. When I don't include any supernova feedback, star formation in the small halos actually makes a big contribution to the total star formation rate. So suppressing it with reionization makes a big difference, and you get the blue line. In these cases, those small halos never made a big contribution to the star formation rate anyway. They're already so strongly suppressed with the supernova feedback. So whether you see this big change in the star formation rate really depends on whether there's any other feedback acting as well. This is essentially a numerical effect that these models are done by producing many Monte Carlo realizations of individual galaxies. So this is just limited statistics, basically. Yeah, essentially. Yeah, it gives you some idea of the scatter. The problem at high redshifts is that there are so few objects around that essentially the Poisson noise is very big. So. So what I want to show you now is results at redshift zero, and this is starting with just the sort of global population of galaxies averaged over a large fraction of the universe. This is their B-band luminosity function. Lots of faint galaxies, very few bright ones. The red points here are the observational results from the 2DF galaxy redshift survey. This is one of the best determinations of the luminosity function we have right now. So the green line in this case is my model without the effects of reionization included. And you see it's doing reasonably well at the bright end here, but it's producing too many galaxies at these faint magnitudes. If I switch on reionization, this photosuppression as I call it, then you don't have too much effect on the bright end, because those galaxies are too big to be affected by the Jeans mass, so they don't really care about this. But you suppress the number of galaxies at the faint end. And you're actually now getting much closer to the data. The slope is fairly comparable. If I switch on the effects of the tidal limitation as well, the tidal destruction of galaxies, then I get a little more suppression, but it's a fairly minor effect. But the bottom line is there that at the end...
Why is it going up? Why is the blue line higher than the pink line?
I think why does it work like that? It ends up with you being, because you destroy a lot of the small galaxies, you end up with more gas remaining at late times to form some brighter galaxies as well. So it's often the effects on the faint and bright end are sort of opposite. There's also some noise there, but I think in this case.
Yeah, I just don't think, if I take that
little
here,
just right. I mean, down here you have, very, very few objects, so. So you actually do slightly suppress things here as well. So this is one of the surprising things, that if you take this filtering mass approach to calculating how much gas the halo accretes, it actually suppresses quite large halos. And that's a result from one set of numerical simulations. So it would be nice to see that repeated in other simulations, but at the minute that's all we have to go on. And I certainly found it quite surprising when I first did the calculation that it had an effect on such bright galaxies.
But,
yeah, the Milky Way is sitting somewhere around here.
I mean, you have to get a little careful. I mean, this is a luminosity function, I guess. You could plot out versus the halo path, what the luminosity is.
Right. That's the other possibility.
You're not changing the number of halos, you're changing
the luminosity. I mean, the other comment is that this is not bad. This is, you know, going from first principles to get this level of fit to the data, but it's not perfect. You know, we're still not doing that well around the knee and the luminosity function. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So, I'm going to skip over that because I don't want to focus on that for now. Yeah. Let me move on to the local group, which is the thing that I really wanted to talk about. So this is another luminosity function. This is in the V band this time. And this is just the number of galaxies in the local group. And this is just the things inside the green circle that I'm talking about from that earlier figure. So the red points are the observational data. So you see this luminosity function is fairly flat, goes down to around minus 9, and the brightest thing is sort of some things like the LMC. And the green line here is the result of this galaxy model without the effects of any reionization. So you can see a few things. I should say I did many realizations of a Milky Way halo and just plotted the median luminosity function. So you see a couple of things. First of all, it's a really bad fit to the data. We don't produce enough of these really bright objects like the LMC. And as expected, we produce over an order of magnitude too many of the faint galaxies. This is just the problem I talked about right at the beginning. The reason this thing turns over at these very faint magnitudes is that you get to very small halos, the gas is unable to cool effectively because it's not sufficiently ionized. And I should also say that I plotted this down to very faint magnitudes, but at some point you'd stop calling these things galaxies and just very small collections of stars, so I would not really believe things in this very faintest part. But I thought I'd just show you.
Well, anyway. You're simulating the halo. I mean, you're applying some constraint that these things are satellites near or mass.
Yeah, thanks. That's a good point. So what I do is simulate halos, a large number of halos in a mass range around what we expect for the Milky Way. So in the region of 10 to 12 solar masses. And then in each of those, I go and look at the galaxy that formed and see if it, and just pick out those ones which look something like the Milky Way. So have about the right mass and the right morphological type. And then I'm just plotting the results from those ones. It actually doesn't make such a big difference if you just plot all halos of 10 to 12 solar masses. But we do account for that. So the first thing I'm going to do is switch on this tidal disruption of satellite galaxies. And you see it makes some effect. You essentially take some of these galaxies, remove some of their stars, and make them slightly fainter. But it's not really helping us get anywhere near the data at all. So this is a fairly minor contribution. If I switch on the effects of reionization, this photosuppression, they have a much bigger effect. You can see that we have suppressed the number by about a factor of 8 or so, I think, at these faint magnitudes, which is sort of what was the basic hope, that you would suppress the formation of a lot of these dwarf galaxies and get closer to the data. And yes, we really are closer to the data.
Are those shortcut-offs? Are those induced or are those real?
So I'll show a little more of this in a second. This is really a consequence of what I'm plotting, because I'm plotting the median number. So sometimes that median can be zero and it's a log scale. In fact, what I want to show is that this is still not such a good fit to the data, but we should account for the fact that the local group is just one object, it's one realization. So we should really consider if there's any scatter predicted by a model as well. So let me keep that blue line there, but show you the scatter I get in this model. So the blue line just still shows you the median. These shaded regions enclose different fractions of the whole distribution of models. So you'll see that the faint end here, things aren't too bad. Something like 10% of models produce sufficiently few galaxies that they would lie right on top of these points. And also, as we said, there's some chance that these points may be slightly incomplete. So I'm not too worried about things there.
Are the Milky Way and Andromeda those 2 points there?
No.
They're
off the scale. These are the one of these is LMC and the other is I don't know which way around it is.
I don't understand these shades of gray. They don't.
So yeah, so the lightest gray in the center encloses 50% of the model of the large number of models that I ran. Yeah, the inner two quartiles. Then this contains 80%, 90%, and the outer region contains all the models, which is not a statistically stable thing to do, but it just shows you the extremes that I found. So the
model has
yeah, well, there's actually one very small number here. If you do this calculation in detail, you find there's about a 3% chance of any of these realizations producing something like the LMC. So that's pretty rare. It's very difficult to produce something that bright. Another interesting thing is that we always produce, you know, the data stop here. There's nothing beyond there. Now maybe it's just that those things haven't been found, but this model suddenly predicts that you should keep on producing more and more of these very faint objects. So two problems. One is that we have too many objects here still, not enough here. The real problem is that the shape of the luminosity function is wrong. The data is very flat, has a slope like this, but the model is much, much steeper still. And this photo suppression really hasn't helped make the luminosity function any flatter. It does slightly, but it's not enough. So this is a real problem. And at this point, I have to admit that there's a good possibility that this is just that the astrophysics is too messy, too difficult, and perhaps we shouldn't be surprised that this modeling of this complexity isn't able to produce really good agreement with the data. So it sort of comes back to Mark's point that we have to accept that maybe it's not the underlying model that's wrong, it's just our inability to calculate. But it certainly demonstrates that this reionization is quite a big suppressor of small galaxies. It really did reduce the number by a factor of 10. Whether the details are right is a sort of a higher order concern. So I'm going to skip some of these things. So this is an interesting related topic, and that's that if this mechanism really is at work, you stop any galaxies, any faint galaxies forming, but all that dark matter structure should still be there. And there are, in fact, observations of lensing around galaxies, which people have attributed to this dark matter substructure. And the rates are in reasonable agreement with the abundance of structures you'd expect in a cold dark matter model. So this is nice, it's a direct detection. If you really believe the observations. So another possibility, another way to constrain the presence of these objects is through their effects on galactic disks. So if all these objects are orbiting around in the Milky Way's halo, occasionally one of them will pass through the disk of the Milky Way itself, and it's going to transfer energy to the stars in the disk, and if you do that enough, you're going to thicken up the disk. Okay, I have a simple picture of that. So you have an orbiting satellite, passes through this nice thin disk, and eventually it thickens it up. So if you can calculate the amount of thickening you expect, you can then compare that with what we actually observe. And if it's too much, then maybe you can rule out the presence of these objects. So unfortunately, it's quite a difficult thing to do. But we have this detailed model of satellite orbits that I use for the tidal mass loss calculations. So I'm just showing you some tests of it here. The red points, this is plotting orbital properties of a satellite orbiting around something like the Milky Way. The red points here are from simulations by Velasquez and White, where they just did M-body calculations of this. So on the upper panel, I show you the orbital radius as a function of time. And the blue line is trying to reproduce that with my analytic model. And you see it works pretty well. It's not that surprising that you get the sort of period, right? That just depends on the the growth structure of the halo, but you see that it produces the right decay in the orbit as well, which is the dynamical friction, which is a little harder to do. The center panel shows you the remaining mass of that satellite as it's experiencing tidal mass loss. And again, we reproduce the trend there very nicely, so this is pretty pleasing. And the bottom panel is the amount of energy that this satellite has given to the disk of the Milky Way as a function of time. So again, the red points are from the simulation. Blue points here are from our model. And you see there the agreement is not as good. These are actually their arbitrary units, I think. See how this works. So EEZ is just the vertical component of the kinetic energy. Exactly.
So it is a velocity dispersion.
Yes, that's right. I think the units work that if this was equal to EEZ was equal to 1, then you essentially turn the disk into a spheroid, roughly speaking. So this is quite a small amount of heating, actually. Yes, precisely, yeah. So what I can do is to go back to my model of the formation of some Milky Ways, add up all the contributions from their orbiting satellites and find out how much energy their disks get. I know the velocity dispersion, I can work out what the height of those disks should be. And so what I'm plotting here is I simulated a large number of them, calculated the scale height of the disk H, and this is expressed in units of their radial scale length, so it's sort of the ratio of height to length, and just plot the distribution. And this is, I marked on here that 0.1 is about the ratio, it's about the number for the Milky Way, at least for the thin component of the Milky Way's disk. And you see that the prediction peaks somewhere just a little bit larger than that, but it's fairly close. And the Milky Way wouldn't be at all atypical in this cosmology. The radial scale length of the disk is about three or four.
That's
yeah.
So 10% of that would be 300
kiloparsecs. Yeah.
Not high.
No, it's 300 parsecs.
Wait.
Yeah.
Is that
0.1
or 1%?
Three kiloparsecs, I think a tenth of that, I mean, three kiloparsecs.
But 300 parsecs is a big number compared to the scale height of our disk, isn't it?
No, I think that's about the number. It's about 350. That's what I'm considering with the thin disk. It's about 350 parsecs.
I mean, that's sort of the instantaneous gift. Right. That the satellites
that
have fallen in quite a while ago left.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's a good point. I mean, this is kind of an average over the entire history. I could separate out, you know, early components and produce a thick disk, but so it's the average.
There's some indication that there's a tail.
You would say that there are many galaxies in which the disk is pretty fluffy.
Right, so that's a good point, that this distribution does extend right out to essentially a ratio of 1 to 1, which is these things would no longer be disks, they're just, you know, completely destroyed. So I'm not sure how you would even identify those objects.
Well, what would they be?
Yeah, I'm not really sure.
When they get really puffy, are there other processes that you're not considering that could drive them back towards them?
Not that I know of. Not that I've really come across. There are other processes which this actually just includes the heating from substructures. You also get heating by scattering stars from molecular clouds in disks. If you put that in as well, you sort of tighten up the the low ratio end of the distribution, and you don't really make too much change here. So that's sort of the two major heating mechanisms. But the bottom line of this is that you expect a distribution fairly well peaked around ratios of 0.1, 0.2. Unfortunately, at the minute, there are no really good samples of galaxies where you can measure this. I think there have been a few things recently from the two mass survey, so it might be possible to compare with those results, but. That's right. I think the real problem in the past has been that although you have the image edge on, you're really dominated by the seeing, so you can't measure the scale height that well.
Right, but there are constraints in front of
it. Yeah, so you can put good constraints. Yeah.
So we need conclusion is that things are okay. I mean, that substructure can't be ruled out at least.
Sorry, I think on the basis of what we now know, you can't rule out the presence of substructure by its effect on disks. The interesting thing that if you had, this is all for the sort of standard lambda cosmology. Had an omega 1 cosmology, this would actually be shifted quite a long way to higher ratios, just because there's so much more infall and mass flying around. So the lambda is really helping here. Let's see. Let's skip over this stuff. So I just wanted to finish on. Yeah.
You got a reference to velocity dispersion in the low mass satellite.
Yes.
To compare it to measurements.
That's right.
Done that?
We have done that, and the result is very similar to what we see for the luminosity function, that we produce too few of the highest velocity dispersions and slightly too many of the lowest velocity dispersions. So that's not surprising, because there's quite a nice correlation between luminosity and velocity.
So there is a rough sigma-m correlation?
Yeah. We actually... Yeah, that's the funny thing, that we actually reproduced that fairly well, the relation between sigma and luminosity. It's just that the total numbers of objects are wrong in both cases.
But that is affected by the annotation correction.
That would be true, yeah. Yes. Okay, so I just wanted to finish a few minutes talking about galaxy clustering. So we saw a similar picture to this on Wednesday. So this is just an n-body simulation of a region of the universe about 140 megaparsecs on the side. The grayscale here is dark matter, so you see all the usual kind of filamentary structure that we're used to seeing. And these colored circles are just the positions of galaxies that I've placed into this simulation using the same model of galaxy formation. So it's just work from my PhD thesis, basically, but we're able to show that by doing this, you could reproduce certain observations of galaxy clustering. So the green points here are the galaxy two-point correlation function from the APM survey. The dashed line here is the correlation function of dark matter in this cosmology, and you see it doesn't agree with the observations. But the galaxies in this model actually do much better. They're biased and reproduce the data reasonably well. We also produce other things, such as this just shows you the variation in clustering strength with luminosity, such that brighter galaxies are more strongly clustered. The black line is the prediction from this model, and the red points here, which is sort of the best data set currently going from the 2DF, are matching up reasonably nicely, so that's quite pleasing. What I wanted to talk about a little was just the properties of voids in these universes. So you see there are things in the dark matter, there are regions of very low density, but they're not empty. You see in this region, for example, there are these small dark matter structures in there. So,
could I just check?
Yeah.
So there are strings of black dots.
Yes.
They're identified as
dark matter halos. So what I'm plotting here is just galaxies brightening around L star. So these things may have fainter galaxies in. And of course, this is the interesting question. So these things are not completely empty of dark matter. You can kind of tell by eye. Unfortunately, I don't have time to make all the plots, but I can show anyone who's interested that they're also devoid of galaxies to some extent. And it turns out that they're actually more devoid of galaxies than they are of dark matter, such that the typical overdensity of galaxies in these regions is slightly lower than that of the overdensity of dark matter. So this is an effect of galaxy biasing, which is helping to produce empty voids in these universes. And whether it's sufficient to explain the observations is another question. Right. So the basic reason there aren't any galaxies in this model is that two things. Firstly, the dark matter objects that do form in the voids are typically much lower mass than the average dark matter object. If you can get that from Chris Schechter, it's easy to understand. And then, because we do include some feedback in these models, the mass to light ratios of galaxies rises very, very rapidly as you go to the lower mass halos. So that if you go down a factor of 10 in halo mass, the luminosity goes down by a factor of 100 or more. It's because the feedback gets ever, ever stronger. So you're kind of preferentially suppressing galaxies that would form in these regions.
But it's still a one-to-one mapping.
It's still a one-to-one mapping. Yeah. Right. There is the possibility, like you said, that you'd have, like, if these regions of the universe got ionized earlier than anything else, which is quite plausible, then that could be an extra effect. That's not included at present. Yes, it does. But in a sort of spatially average sense, in a homogeneous way.
Is it possible that the places where there's lots of stuff could be self-shielded from the invasion, from the ionized from the...
You kind of mean these regions or like these things?
Yeah.
I mean,
in which case there would be a different ionizing plus in the dense region supposed to be under.
Right. I think by redshift zero that's not true. I mean, when people have done simulations of reionization, you see that these regions are the last to get ionized. That's because they have high recombination rates and you shield the inner regions. But eventually everything gets ionized. Yeah.
It's driving me crazy. I agree that this thing looks pretty empty.
Yeah.
But is this considered part of the void? And what about all of these little temples?
Yes. So this is a good question, and I'm not sure I know the answer.
The answer is probably that it's going to get it down.
Oh, no.
Well, I mean, this is some kind of filamentary thing, yeah. But
there is theory, or is this an artifact of the grid? Why do I see a series of spots?
Oh, okay.
Probably a series of the halo part.
Yeah, so you're just breaking this filament up into very small halos.
You are not, you're plotting the true dark matter distribution. You are plotting some sort of...
Well, it's plotting the true dark mass distribution.
Yeah, here's a smooth region. So I got to believe these are within the model physical.
Yes.
Rather than...
Well, I'd be a little careful. I mean, this is plotted in such a way to bring out the structure. Like just the contrast is designed that way.
The result of discretizing a smooth zone.
Well, I mean, I think... Yeah, I mean, partly it's that. I mean, I think a large fraction of these objects you're seeing are actually real, what you would call a real concentration, a real halo. Some of these really tiny little things are probably just essentially Poisson noise, it's just fluctuations, small particles. But yeah, I mean, whether you would, what you would call this thing, would you call this a void with a few things sitting in it, or is it just this region that's a void?
You see, I see a lot of things.
Right.
I wonder how many of them were aware of.
Yes.
How thin is that slice?
This is about 10 megaparsecs thick. About 150, yeah. Yeah.
That's 10%.
Yes.
Which is lots of surface.
Right. So, I mean, yeah. So what I really wanted to do, because, you know, there are some things which look like voids, but we don't know if this really looks like the real universe, was to actually just compute some statistics related to the presence of voids. And the other problem is that observationally there have been, the sort of samples of galaxies are not that good for statistically quantifying voids, just because voids are very big, so you don't get many in a survey. And also you want to look at faint galaxies, so that's very hard observationally as well. Things like the Sloan are probably going to fix that. You know, they have much bigger volumes and look quite faint magnitudes. So we want to just put together some predictions that you can then compare in a straightforward way with the data when it arrives. So I'm just going to show you one really simple one. We actually looked at many others as well. This is what's known as the void probability function. So it's really simple. You throw down a sphere of some radius r at a random position in that region of the universe, and you see if there are any galaxies inside it. And then you repeat that lots and lots of times and work out the fraction of these spheres which contain zero galaxies. And of course, if you go to very small spheres, then nearly all of them contain zero galaxies. You get out to really big things, very, very few of them. Of course, this is sensitive to the presence of big holes in your survey. So these are all similar, all for different kinds of galaxies. These are fairly faint things, things around L star and very bright objects. The red line in each case is what you'd get for a random distribution of points, just a purely randomly distributed set of galaxies. And you see it drops off in an exponential way as you go to larger radii. The black line is the result for dark matter, with the same sample to have the same number density. Because, of course,
dark matter here above some threshold.
No, this is just all dark matter. So each dark matter particle can. So what I did was randomly sampled the dark matter to produce just a certain number of particles in the volume. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And you see that there are many more large holes in this distribution of dark matter than there were for a random distribution. And it's not at all surprising, because you know the dark matter is clustered, so you must have made holes in that distribution in order to produce a clustered distribution. The green line is what I get for galaxies with the same total number density. And you'll see that it's, again, even more full of holes than the dark matter was. And this is a consequence of that biasing effect that I showed you earlier, that you empty out the voids even more of galaxies than you do of dark matter. But the differences are actually not that big. And if you take the current observational estimates, for example, from the CFA surveys, then they clearly disagree with this red line, which is just a random distribution. You can't really distinguish between the black or green one. But
could you tell us what is the difference among six panels?
Yes.
It seems to be the luminosity.
That's right. So this is, these labels are not very clear. So these are going from faint to very bright galaxies.
Yes, but of course the red line doesn't care about
the
red, right?
No, it only cares about the number density. So because the luminosity of the galaxies is changing,
yes,
the total number density is changing. So these faint things, there are about 70,000 in that region. Because I sample the dark matter to have the same number of particles.
Okay,
that seems like the fairest way to compare. And of course, when you get to these really bright objects, there's essentially no way with a poor statistic to discriminate between a random distribution and a galaxy distribution. But for these faint things, which are the ones we're really interested in, the significant differences, and you ought to be able to really test this with the Sloan or 2DF surveys.
So could you tell us for the faintest of these, what does it look like on the 2DF map?
So the faintest, so the size of the circles here is proportional to the, well, related to the luminosity, so the smallest objects you see correspond. The smallest size in terms of radius.
The black fellows are not in your system.
So for the colored circles, these very smallest ones correspond to the left-hand panel.
Okay.
For the dark matter grayscale, all particles are treated equally.
You're assuming that all of those black fellows are not visible.
Yes, that's right. If we went to fainter magnitudes, some of these would suddenly light up and we'd see fainter galaxies in them. But of course, there's a you run into numerical problems that the simulation doesn't really resolve all of these small objects that well. So you have to be careful of not going too faint. So we calculated many other statistics as well, such as nearest neighbor distributions for these galaxies. Distributions of void radii and essentially everything we could think of, so it's quite a comprehensive set of predictions. I'll skip over all this stuff. That's very interesting. So I just very quickly run through the conclusions. I showed you this model for the evolution of galaxies in the IGM. So it's pretty much the first time that you've been able to follow the evolution of these two components of the universe in a self-consistent way, and including this suppression of galaxy formation and the orbital evolution of satellite galaxies. So it was able to flatten the luminosity function pretty well and agrees well with the data as I showed you. But in the local group, well, to zero order it works. It really does help reduce the abundance of satellites to about the level that we observe. So this is a good thing. When you get into the details, things don't work quite so well. So there's still problems there. I didn't talk about that at all. So I just listed a few successes for this cold dark matter and photoionization picture. I mentioned the first two. You also get the heating rate of disks about right. The velocity dispersions of the satellites look okay as well. And lensing rates agree with what we predict from this model. I also mentioned the two failures, that it doesn't, actually I didn't mention this one, doesn't produce a flat local group luminosity function. So the question is, well, first of all, maybe this modeling is not robust. Maybe it's not, you know, maybe we're not doing it sufficiently accurately. That's certainly possible. We really need other people to check that. It'd be nice to approach this using direct numerical simulations as well as an alternative way to check it. But if it turns out it is robust, what are the remaining possibilities? Well, one is that you'd still need to modify a picture of dark matter. You maybe still need some warm or interacting dark matter. Or it's not clear that this is actually going to work. That still needs to be demonstrated. The other thing is that maybe we're still missing important physics for the formation of faint galaxies, either missing it or not understanding it sufficiently well. The real problem in my mind is star formation and the associated feedback. We really don't understand that very well at all. And my money would be on this one, that this is much more likely because the physics is just so much more complex. So I'll finish at that point.
Can I be a test and ask you to go back once more to the map?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Let me actually scroll through.
And ask about the typical properties of the black star.
Mm-hmm.
AI, escape velocity.
Okay. Here's the next one. Yeah.
Right.
So the smallest physical object we can find in these simulations has a mass of around 10 to the 11th solar masses. Dark mass, yeah. So that's around a tenth of the Milky Way. So its velocity dispersion would be of order 100 kilometers per second. So that's still quite big. Yes, that's right. So it doesn't have, photoionization doesn't have too much effect on these simulations. If you started going to much smaller objects, it would become important.
Well, just to be sure I understand, I'm referring to the black, to a typical black dot.
To these kind of,
yeah.
Yeah.
I hate to say it, but I'm really obsessed by
right.
fellows like that.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Which just are very rare in the real world.
Okay, yeah. They must be. They're about that. They're about 10 to the 11 solar masses.
What are the masses of the particle?
Each particle in this is about 10 to the 10. The smallest thing we consider a physical object is 10 particles. Well, this is an interesting thing. You have to be very careful. We actually do a much more. You can do it that way. Go to a smaller box. Most of these are actually really are physical. You can check this quite nicely just by doing things with different resolutions.
Yeah.
And we don't just do the simple group finders that people normally do. We actually apply criteria to check that these are real physical, you know, self-bound objects. And you do throw away a lot of things which would normally be kept. So you have to be very careful.
Now, when you consider the, you know, the feedback on the stars.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, are you modeling these things as pure stars, the satellites?
No, they're a mixture of stars and dark matter.
But no gas, like no molecular clouds.
There's gas in there. It's treated it's treated as being collisionless for those calculations. You're not accounting for any, you know, hydrodynamical forces
right.
that may
so,
affect
so these
that
are
gas.
Dwarf spheroidals or something.
Yeah. Right.
In what local group, how much of the luminosity when you look at a satellite is coming from the old stellar population? How much is actually from stuff that was associated with star formation?
That's a good question.
I would say for the LMC, for example, a lot of that luminosity is the significant part is in the younger.
That's certainly true. Things like that. So it's.
I'd worry that you might have to make some corrections to your luminosity.
Right. So this is. That's why it's nicer to go to the sigma, which is more related to the mass. The luminosities are always a problem because you have, you know, the contamination by recent stars. I mean, all of these objects do have some population of very old stars in them, but they nearly all have evidence of recent bursts of star formation as well.
So maybe you could make an estimate of correcting down the data,
That's possible. I mean, in principle, this model would account for that recent star formation. In practice, it doesn't actually agree with the observations that well. But.
Well, I mean, there you have to worry about salt shield.
Right. I mean, to be honest, my bigger concern is that, of course, in this kind of modeling, the star formation rates are based on a purely empirical model, which you constrain to match the properties of bright galaxies. And then I've just extrapolated it way down to these faint things. And I don't think there's any reason to expect that it should really behave in that way. But without a physical model, there's nothing much more you can do. Yeah, I mean, in the end, I was pretty pleased that you got this factor of almost 10 reduction in the numbers. The rest is, would have been nice if it worked, but it's not too surprising that it doesn't.
So.
Yeah, keep me employed for a while longer.
Now, the photoionization model, is that just the general background? Is there any contribution from, say, the Milky Way?
No, it's purely a average background. Of course, there may be some influence from the Milky Way. In fact, most of these dwarf galaxies formed long before the Milky Way did, so hopefully isn't too big an effect. But then,
recent truncation.
Yeah. So that's, yeah, another problem. But it starts to get very difficult to do things like that analytically now. But of course, it's very difficult to do numerically as well. So. Okay.